Well, we have just sung that we have ripped the idols out of our heart and gotten rid of them, which fits in quite well with our series of lessons we started this morning about idolatry and how there are modern ways that we can be guilty of idolatry. And so we talked about that as a general topic, and tonight we want to see what are the three main idols that tempt us away from God, a kind of devilish trinity of sorts. And just as we really began with Psalm 138 this morning, we can begin with Psalm 23, a psalm that retains its power and significance no matter how often it may be recited, no matter how trite it may become to some. There is a reason why it is probably the most popular of all of the psalms. The Lord is my shepherd. I will not lack anything. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You've anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, this cuts to the very heart of what idolatry is about, whether it is image worship or the modern forms that idolatry takes. It's, as we were looking at this morning, really any attempt to save yourself is idolatry. That would be a very simple definition of idolatry, an attempt at self-salvation. We've often observed that the root of all sin is self. That's not the only way to phrase it, but that's really the idea here once again. At the root of every idol is our own self. We may think that we're really serving something else, but ultimately we think we're serving ourselves. It is our self-interest that is in focus. And we think there are different avenues to get there. Money is what's going to make me happy, or being popular or wielding power and influence, being known for being brilliantly intelligent or being fabulously beautiful. These are the things that are the paths to success and true happiness. And so really, one way we could describe what all idolatry is it is the soul of a person looking for security. We're longing for something. There's something we fear. There's something we are missing. And we think the answer to what we're missing, or the solution to that fear, that which is going to provide us real security, is in this particular thing. And so if we could understand ourselves, if we can understand what we think will make us secure, if we understand what our fears are, if we understand what it is we really think we're missing out on in life, this would get us to the real heart of our particular form of idolatry. And that, there you see how Psalm 23 fits in. Here is a person who doesn't lack anything. If you feel like you don't lack anything, you're not missing anything, you don't fear anything, I fear no evil, I don't even fear death. There's a person who is truly happy and content in life, and who is not vulnerable to all the various idolatries that appeal and lure us away from God. He has found his satisfaction in God. He has found his every need supplied in God. He doesn't need anything else but God. That's where we need to be. Where the 23rd Psalm really takes on full significance and meaning for us, because we have found our true satisfaction in God, and there are not the fears that we're missing something or lacking something that we're trying to find the answer or the fulfillment to somewhere else. You know, the first song that we sang tonight, "There Is Much to Do," the real focus of this song is on the desperate need that people have. The cry for help comes ringing through the land. There's the plaintive cry of mourning souls distressed, and the sigh of hearts who seek but find no rest. There are hungering souls who cry aloud for bread. With the bread of life, they're longing to be fed. The problem, of course, is they don't really know what they're longing for or what they're starving for. They don't know where the answer is found. And those are powerful images as we think about this desperate need for God and longing for God, that really that's what everybody's looking for. Everybody wants to be happy. But what do we mean by happy? Well, everybody wants that sense of security. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, the Bible tells us that ultimately when you get to the bottom of it all, what everybody is really looking for is God, even though they may not know it. Now, so here's a person who pursues drug addiction because in some warped way they think that's going to solve their problem. Here's a person that pursues a sexual addiction. Here's a person that pursues lying. Here's a person that pursues material prosperity. And in all of these desperate efforts, people are really trying to find God. But they don't really know where to look. They don't know where to begin. I think it was John Calvin who said, "The heart is a perpetual factory of idols." And I think he was really getting at the truth there. Real idols are not manufactured in an idol factory. Let's make a gold image, let's make a silver image, let's make a wood image. The real idols are manufactured in the heart. And what was fabricated as images for people to bow down to was really first created in the heart of man. And so we're not bowing down to overt images today, but we have nonetheless created our various idols that are going to bring that security, that are going to dispel that fear that we have, that's going to satisfy that longing or that sense of what we're missing out on. And so, one way I guess we could try to solve this problem is we could make a bunch of rules. So, for example, if my idol is money, and I think money's the path to happiness, and that's what's going to solve all my problems, I can start coming up with some rules and say, you shall only earn X number of dollars a year. You shall only save X number of dollars. Or you should only work X number of hours a week, and so on, right? And you might even be successful in implementing some of these rules and getting people to follow them. But will you have destroyed the idolatry that is in their heart? You know, until you get to the heart of the problem, what they are fearing, what they think they're missing, what they think they're looking for, you've not really solved the problem of their idolatry. And that's why the person who sets there and, whatever rule you come up with, they can just say, well, the Bible doesn't say that. You know, the Bible doesn't give me a dollar amount. The Bible doesn't give me a number of hours per week maximum to work. And so they can always quibble. They can always object to your rule. But when you get to the heart of it, and people can deal with the real heart of the issue, then the issue becomes indisputable. We could have someone who is seeking approval by other people and to fit in by wearing certain clothing, and it may not be particularly modest. And so we come up with some rules, and we say you shall only wear a skirt that is X number of inches below or above the knee or whatever. And once again, someone will say, well, that's just your man-made rule. Where in the Bible does it say, I can only wear this or that? But the real problem, again, it doesn't get to the heart of the issue. What is it that makes you want to dress that way? That's the real question. What do you think you're missing? What fear is driving you to behave this way? Because there is some idol at work, and the more you are aware of that and put it out there in the open on the table, you can deal with the real issue. And I'm afraid even sometimes when we come up with various rules, and some rules are good, some rules are good advice, some rules are actually spelled out in the Bible in terms of some specifics and details. But sometimes we can even become so distracted by the particular rules that we miss the forest for the trees, so to speak. And that's what we're talking about here is get to the real heart of the issue. What is it that we fear? What is it that we think we miss? What is it that we are longing for? And the basic point is that any time you are trying to find your acceptance or your joy or your hope or your significance or your security anywhere but in God, you're looking for it in the wrong place. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to be accepted. There's nothing wrong with joy. There's nothing wrong with hope. There's nothing wrong with security. God would have us to have all of these things, but He's telling us, you'll only find these in Me. And once again, it's not that God is being self-centered. It's not as if God's just really hung up on Himself. You know, God's so selfish, and all He can think about Himself, He's just kind of stomping His foot up in heaven. Worship Me! Serve Me! Look at Me! You know, if people did that, it would be, well, childish. But the reason God's saying that is because He's desperately, like a loving father, telling us, this will destroy you. This path that you're going down, it doesn't provide true happiness. That wasn't how you were made. That wasn't what you were created for. And so we will only find true happiness. We will only find our fears dispelled in God. We will only find true acceptance and true joy and true significance and true hope and true security in God. And so when we take all these things, even these good things that God has given, but we elevate them to the place of God, and we try to find in them our salvation and the answer to our problems, then we have made them into our particular form of idolatry. Notice a couple of passages that address this issue again, that get to the heart of the problem. James chapter 1. You'll notice how much of the book of James talks about wealth. Because wealth is one of the primary alternate ways of saving yourself that our world tries to indoctrinate us in. Money is the answer to your problems. But there's a greater wealth, a treasure that's laid up in heaven that is greater than any earthly treasure. And that is found in true wisdom. And so James starts out this letter with a rather bizarre claim. Verse 2, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and endurance must have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. But if any of you lacks something, namely wisdom, he must ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him." You think you're missing something? You think you're lacking something in life? Look for it in God, and you will find it. And he lays out here a process where through what the world would say, are you out of your mind? Rejoice in trial, in suffering, in testing, in deprivation, and difficulty. These things are good. Well, yes, they are, because they develop character. And character produces endurance, and it has its perfect result in which we realize we're not lacking anything. These things that people think are important. Man, I've got to have my health. I've got to have my financial portfolio in shape. I've got to have this or that. No, the only thing you need is God. And is it nice to have money? Sure. Is it nice to have good health? Of course. But do you need it? No. What you need is God. And so we can get to this point where we don't lack anything. That should be our attitude. 1 Peter chapter 3. Here is how Peter addresses the problem. Verse 14, and he's talking in a context of persecution and suffering as well. He says, "Even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed." I mean, these two guys are just talking out of their head from the perspective of the world. Be happy, you're suffering. Be blessed in your persecution. But notice what he says. "Do not fear what they fear, and do not be troubled." And you may notice this is a quotation from Isaiah chapter 8. This is basically what God told the prophet Isaiah long ago. You don't worry about what those people worry about. You don't be afraid of what those people are afraid of. There's just one thing you need to be afraid of. You fear the Lord. You be afraid of letting the Lord down. You just worry about that, and that takes care of every other fear. It puts every other fear in its place. "You do not fear what they fear, and do not be troubled, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart. Set apart Jesus Christ as your Lord and Master, as your holy, you know, person and authority that is commanding you and telling you what to do, always being ready to make a defense to anyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience so that in the thing in which you're slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. You don't fear what the world fears, but rather you put Christ up as Lord, you put Christ in His proper place as the one who is number one, and you glorify Him as God and give Him thanks. And then you're not guilty of idolatry. And so you see, the whole root of this idolatry is this fear and this sense of lacking something, missing out on something, this desperate grasping at security. And that's what leads us astray every time. So, what are the three idols that we're most likely to fall into? Well, turn to Matthew chapter 4, and we will find the story of the temptation of Jesus, I think, instructive in this regard. And you'll immediately recognize where I'm going with this, because Satan tempted Jesus three times. And the nature of these temptations really revolve around, I think, these three tendencies that we have, these three areas in which Satan can tempt us, three things that we think we might really be missing out on, or three things that we fear lacking, that we desperately long for some kind of security in regard to. And these are the same three areas in which he tested Jesus. So Matthew chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. This isn't a haphazard, occasional meeting in the desert. God takes Jesus into the desert on purpose with the intent that he be tested by Satan. And we've talked about this to some extent before, that there are clearly parallels between Jesus' experience here and Israel in the wilderness in the Old Testament. And where Israel failed the test, Jesus will pass the test. And that's seen particularly in the way that Jesus responds to the temptation of Satan every time by quoting the same passage of Scripture, the same very narrow section of Deuteronomy from chapter 6 through chapter 8. But Jesus is taken here to be tested and to show that he is the true Israel. He's the fulfillment of Israel. He's the embodiment of what Israel should have been. And he's able to accomplish what old Israel could not. And after he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he became hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "Since you're the Son of God, command that these stones become bread." Now, I don't know how you've heard this passage preached before, but often the focus of the temptation gets put on the devil's trying to get Jesus to doubt his deity, or that he really is the Messiah. "Or, are you really the Son of God? I don't believe that for a minute. If you really are, well, prove it to me," you know, kind of thing. And that's not what the devil is doing. He is conceding that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, what's the nature of the temptation then? Well, you're the Son of God, for crying out loud. Why in the world do you need to suffer? Why are you hungry? I mean, all you got to do is snap your fingers. I don't even have to do that. And make these rocks into bread, and you've got it made. And of course, if Satan had been successful in getting Jesus to do that, the whole purpose of his coming would have been nullified. You imagine the Hebrew writer saying, "He was tempted in all points as we..." Well, no, wait a minute. No, every time he got in a bind, he worked a miracle and got himself out of it. Yeah, that don't work too well. Well, he didn't do that. You know, people sometimes will say, "Oh, Jesus, he just doesn't know what it's like to live my life." And really, it's the other way around. Jesus knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what it's like to be really tempted. You know, sometimes we think we've been tempted, you know, because we have some particular thing that really just gnaws at us. And we're constantly getting tripped up, and we're succumbing to the same sin, typically, time and time again. And we think, "Oh, we just really struggle with that." Well, the problem is we're not struggling with it nearly hard enough. That's why we keep falling into it. But the problem is, as soon as you give in to the temptation, it's over. Jesus never did that. The end of temptation never came for Jesus. So if there's anybody who has no clue what it's like to be tempted, it's us. because we cave in, but he did not. He endured temptation not only like we have, but beyond. And no one will stand before Jesus on the day of judgment as judge and say, well, you just don't understand. You don't know what it was like. And so his whole ministry, the very work that he came to do, depended upon the fact that he came to accomplish this very thing. And so he's not going to do what Satan says, you know. But notice his answer. He answered and said, it's written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And then the devil took him into the holy city and had him stand on the pinnacle of the temple. Now, no one knows exactly what that is or where it was. Most people seem to think it was the southwest corner of the temple wall. And back in Jesus' day, that's about a 150-foot drop down into the Kidron Valley, which is like a 15-story building. And you can imagine standing there and, you know, just throw yourself off here. And I don't know, for some reason, as a kid, I always pictured this happening like in the middle of the night, you know, like 3 in the morning. There's crickets chirping. That's about it. You know, just the devil and Jesus. Just throw yourself off. We'll see what happens, you know. And in all likelihood, we're to understand this happens in broad daylight. There are going to be thousands of people around. This is going to get a lot of attention. This is going to be a great publicity stunt. So throw yourself off. Since you're the Son of God, throw yourself down, because it's written, he will give his angels charge concerning you. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. You know, test God. Make him prove himself, you know. We'll see if this really happens. How much does God like you, you know? And Jesus said to him, on the other hand, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you fall down and worship me. And Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and began to minister to him. All right, think about these three different temptations that Jesus has given. First of all, is the temptation of possessions, we could describe it. And what I mean by that, what would fit into that category of all of the things that we think are going to bring us comfort in life. And comfort comes in many forms. It can be physical comfort. You know, I don't want to be hungry. You know, I don't want to be hot and sweaty. You know, I don't want to be worried about where my next meal's coming from. I don't want to be worried about having enough money to make my mortgage payment. I don't want to, you know, I fear living out on the street, you know, and having nothing. And on it goes. And so, well, money is pretty much the answer to all those things. If I have enough money, I'll have a right house in the right neighborhood, and I'll have plenty of food, and, you know, I can pay for my medical care, and on it goes. And so we think money is going to solve all of those fears. But some comforts that we look for are not physical or even financial. Some comforts that we seek are more emotional or mental, and we find comfort in some of those things. Well, again, there's nothing wrong with having comforts. There's nothing wrong with having blessings of God, having possessions. Paul makes it very clear in his instruction to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. You know, you've got a lot of wealthy Christians there in Ephesus where you're working, Timothy. You need to teach them how to use their money to do good for others, and how they're really just stewards of it, and they need to use it to further God's purposes. But included in that teaching is that what God gives to us is to be received with thanksgiving. It is to be received as a blessing with joy. Nothing wrong with having stuff, but it has to remain our servant, a tool that we use, and not become our master. And when it becomes our master, when it becomes our idol, when it becomes, you know, like if I lost all my money, I'd be sad. But I would hope that I would not be utterly devastated, as if I've lost my whole life. That was my whole life. I've lost everything. No, I've lost some money, and that's not as pleasant. That's not my preference in life. I don't want to live on the street. I don't want to just eat beans all the time and never have meat again. But that's not the most important thing to me. Hopefully, the most important thing to be is God. And so it's not bread or any other thing, but rather God himself that I would seek to find my satisfaction. And the second thing is people, the relationships that we have. Now here, it's reflected in the fact that there's a relationship that exists between the Son, Jesus, and his Father. And it seemed to me that what Satan is really getting at here in testing Jesus is to say, you know, does God really accept you? Are you really on God's A-list, you know? Is God really going to take care of you? Are you significant enough for God to pay notice to? And so here's one way you can test that. Just throw yourself off. We'll see what happens. You know, if one of my granddaughters was up here rolling around and close to the edge, going to roll over, I mean, I wouldn't just stand there and say, well, we'll kind of watch this. No, you know, if you care, you intervene, you know, oh, this child is significant to me. And prove that by the way you do whatever it takes to rescue them from any imminent danger that they may be in. And you think about how many people are seeking approval from others, some sense of acceptance. You know, they don't really care to have a lot of money. It's not that important to them. But boy, they desperately want people to like them. And that'll drive you to have all kinds of idols that you will pursue, all kinds of fears that will drive you and make you vulnerable to the temptation of idolatry. And then finally, there's the idol of performance. That I'm really going to be somebody because of what I do, what I'm capable of doing, my power that I have. In the worst forms of this, it is the desire to dominate other people and rule over other people. And this is what Satan offered Jesus, ruling over all of the earth. Well, it's kind of ironic because Jesus did come to rule over the entire earth. He, in fact, is, in one sense, already the ruler of the entire earth as well as the entire universe, whether people acknowledge it or not. But this kind of rule of domination, be somebody important. And so you start seeing how the lines between these things can be blurred a little bit, because somebody might have the idol of money because of the comforts it brings to them. Another person may pursue the idol of money because it makes them fit in with the right crowd. Another person might want all this money because it is a testimony to the world of what a self-made man he is and how great that he is and set him apart above everybody else. It's the same idol in one sense, but it's three different idols in a different sense because of how it's manifesting itself. It's the idol of possessions or the idol of our relationships with people or the idol of our, you know, performance. And how it peculiarly manifests itself in different ways. That's one of the things we'll be looking at in the next few lessons, how these idolatries can specifically manifest themselves in different ways, that we might be aware of these things and we might challenge them in our own life. And if we have a kind of relationship with somebody else that we can be honest with them, we can start helping hold them accountable to what their fears are, what they think they're missing out on, what they think they need in life to find true happiness and satisfaction. Because as you can well imagine, it gets kind of difficult. Because let's say that I'm neglecting my family to work so much, I'm making so much money. And you come to me and say, Tom, I'm concerned. You're working so much. You're neglecting your family. You know, why are you doing this? Well, I'm just saving up every penny to support this, you know, ministry over here in, you know, Zimbabwe to feed all these poor starving Christians. Well, that sounds like a really noble thing to do. I mean, who would criticize that? What a wonderful way to use your money. There's nothing selfish or greedy or materialistic or idolatrous about that. Right? But maybe the reason I'm wanting to do this is because what people will think of me. You know, I'm really going to be somebody now. I'm going to have this reputation for being a very generous and kind and selfless person. And so an act of selflessness actually really is an act of selfishness and is just as much an idol as if I was scraping every penny together and just hoarding it in my closet. And so we got to be very careful about how these idols truly manifest themselves in a variety of ways. And so if you think about these different idols, if you want one kind of catchword to describe what really drives the people in these different categories, the first person, he wants to be happy. You know, that superficial kind of contentment, pleasure in life, freedom from any kind of deprivation, I'm just happy. You just find that sense of contentment and comfort zone, see? That's what that person's interested in. The other person, they can endure any kind of suffering and difficulty as long as people like them. If they've got that, they can get through anything. That's their comfort. That's the thing. They won't be comfortable unless they've got that. And so keep your fancy houses and your bank accounts full of money. I don't care about that. But boy, if people don't like me, I can't live with myself. I have no sense of self-respect. And so some people want to be happy. Some people want to be liked. And some people want to be envied. You know, they got to be top of the pile. They like to throw their weight around. They like to have the power. And they have no real sense of self-worth unless they are the ones that are the top of the game, best at whatever the category is. And so whichever one of these idols it may be, we have to guard against them and stay away from them. And so how can we overcome idolatry? Well, the same way Jesus did. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter gives us an insight into how Jesus was able to overcome the temptation of Satan. And of course, the temptation of Jesus was not just something that happened three times in the desert a long time ago. It was something that pretty much happened constantly in his life. And so, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, you've been called for this very purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his footsteps. He who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. While being reviled, he didn't revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. See, that's the real key. Jesus wasn't trying to find happiness somewhere else. He wasn't trying to find significance and acceptance and self-worth somewhere else. He wasn't trying to find his joy and his hope and his security somewhere else. He entrusted himself to God who judges righteously. God will take care of it all. I don't need anything else. I'm fully content. I'm fully satisfied. Enough is a word that describes my whole life, because I have God, and God is more than enough. And as Peter's saying here, this is a pattern for us to follow. We too should be able to entrust ourselves to him who judges righteously, and to escape temptation, because that's pretty much what he says at the very end of chapter 4 in verse 19. Therefore, let those also who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And Philippians chapter 3, we've recently looked at this in the series of lessons that Nathan has been doing, but it fits in quite well with the point. Philippians chapter 3, Paul gives a very good example of things that were good in and of themselves, benefits, blessings, types of things people could point to as accomplishments. And what does he say about that? Verse 7, Philippians chapter 3, whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I've suffered the loss of all things and count them but excrement, dung, manure. You talk about garbage, you can talk about something that's worthless, in order that I may gain Christ and may be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law. Again, performance-based. Look what I have done. Look what I deserve. But that which is through trust in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of trust, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, in order that I may attain to the resurrection from the dead. That has to be our attitude. anything I might have accomplished, anything that I have, it's nothing. Because the thing I'm focused on is knowing God. As long as God is in His rightful place and I glorify Him as God and I'm thankful to God and I keep my focus on God, I will not be lured away into idolatry. You know, that's the whole gimmick of advertising. The advertiser has to convince you, I just don't know how you can live another day without this product. How can you get through life? You're a miserable wretch of a human being. You can't be happy. Nobody likes you. You're a nobody. Unless you've got this particular brand of toothpaste, or you buy this particular, you know, set of clothing, or you drive this particular car. You know, every advertisement you see is geared toward making you discontent, dissatisfied with what you have, what you don't have. But no amount of advertising can even make a dent in your thinking as long as you're perfectly satisfied. I got no interest in that. It doesn't appeal to me at all. Because I'm not interested in those things. Those things have no allure for me any longer. Those things are nothing compared to God. And finally, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul talks about this attitude and perspective as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 16, therefore, from now on we recognize no man according to the flesh. Even though we have known Christ according to the flesh, you know, Paul at one time looked at Jesus from a worldly perspective. He's just some pretender. He's a blasphemer. He got killed. He got what he deserved. But he came to realize he was wrong, and Jesus was somebody else altogether. Yet now we know him thus no longer. Therefore, if any man is in Christ, a new creation, the old things have passed away. Behold, new things have come. You know, how we look at the world changes. You know, if we're living in the rat race and it's all one big competition to get the biggest slice of the pie, to have the biggest pile of money, everybody else is a competitor. Everybody else is somebody to manipulate and use, to kind of use as a stepping stone to whatever it is we think we need, desperately want. But in Christ, we come to look at people completely differently. People made in the image of God, people that are fallible, broken, sinful, just as we are. And so the gospel isn't some holier-than-thou attempt to, let's see how many people I can convert. And boy, I'll be well known as the great converter of people. Oh, he converted thousands of people in his lifetime. Oh, he must have really been somebody. And have my sense of self-worth as a Christian bound up in things like that. No. Sharing the gospel with somebody is just one hungry person telling another hungry person where to find bread. It's as simple as that. Here's what you desperately need in life. It's what we all desperately need. I've come to understand where the answer is found. And I just want to share that with you too. And so we come to see the masses of people that are hungering for the bread of life. We see the desperate cry of people that are in distress. But we know where the answer is found. And it's found in Jesus and only in Jesus. And finally, in the fourth chapter of 2 Corinthians, verses 16 through 18, this really sums up what we're trying to say here. Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. The outer man's decaying, dying. Now, are you afraid of that? Do you think you're missing something? Is there some way in life you're going to grasp onto some form of security that's going to solve that problem? And that's the great thing about death. Because there is nobody in this world that can delude themselves into thinking that anything can save them from death. The richest person in the world, the most greatest athlete in the world, the best looking person in the world, the most famous person in the world, every single last one of them will die, if nothing else. We might delude ourselves into thinking money will solve poverty, or it's going to solve this particular problem or that particular problem in life, but ultimately, the problem of death scoffs at all of our idols and says, what are you going to do about me? And there is one answer to death. And though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we fear no evil, because God is with us. Even the fear of death is not a fear to be feared. It's not something we're missing out on, because God provides true life, the abundant life, eternal life, that even though we die, we will live, and we will live forever. And a person who has that sense of satisfaction and contentment and acceptability and significance and joy and hope has no need for any idol. He has no fear. He has nothing that he wants, nothing he's lacking. And so what are our idols? Do we think we need things to be happy? Do we think we need people to like us? Do we think we need power to perform, to be somebody? Well, as we will see, God provides the solution and the answer in all of these things. If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 346. Number 346. Won't be very long. You know, whatever it is we think we've got to do here on this earth, whatever it is we think we have to fear, whatever it is we think we're missing out on, in the final analysis, it's such a short period of time anyway. That's what Paul's talking about here. It's temporary. Even the worst persecution that you could endure in this life is temporary compared to eternity. And anything that happens in this life is light, is insubstantial, it's fluff. Even if it's severe persecution, it's nothing compared to the glory of eternity with God. And that's why he says, even if the body is wasting away, even if I'm losing everything, my health is going, my finances are going, my freedom is going, so what? They can take my life. But they can't take what's inside that I have with God that provides my true satisfaction. There is no fear. There's nothing I'm missing because I have God. If there's some way we can help you tonight, let us know while we stand and sing the song of invitation.